Welcome back, everybody. Red Ice TV, great to have you with us. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Today we have back on the show with us Orwell and Good, who has a new book out called A Matter of Time, How Time Preferences Make or Break Civilization. Welcome back, Orwell and Good. Great to have you here again.
Thanks for having me, Henrik. It's a pleasure.
You bet. So let's just dive into this and talk a bit more about the book, How Time Preferences Make or Break Civilization. I think we briefly mentioned it last time you were on, but tell us how the book came together and tell us about the subject matter, how you went about choosing the areas that you did to write about.
Well, as many people, you know, who are on social media and all these other kind of places, all these other platforms that kind of keeping an eye on politics, I came from a libertarian background, and one of the things that really interested me was the concept of time preferences. But in these kind of libertarian and NRX circles, it's almost limited to a materialistic and economic realm. And in this book, I kind of expand the subject and talk about a whole range of topics which can affect one's perception of time and one's usage of time in how they act on a day-to-day, what their preferences are when it comes to the nation, family building, religion, and all these other kind of things. So I hope I make a good case to bring it away from just the economic or material realm and maybe add a bit of value to the whole topic of time preferences. Now, the reason why it interested me was ever since back in those days when I was more interested in economics and in particular Austrian economics, I've drifted away from that now, but was the idea that certain people tend to be more present-minded. They tend to have higher time preferences when they act, because a lot of people don't seem to have the ability to get over their present-minded impulses. So they don't have very good impulse control. And when they act closer to the current moment, and they just live for today, which is a very destructive philosophy, in my opinion, because if you don't leave behind stability or a semblance of a social structure for the future, what are your kids going to inherit? And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we're facing today in the West, is that there's been a demographic change, a very drastic demographic change in Western countries. America is a bit more down that down that rabbit hole than Europe at this stage. But there is a legacy of the generation that lived through the sort of the sexual revolution, the civil rights era, and all these other kind of micro movements within the 60s and 70s. Which took away the concept of looking more towards the future and living more in the here and now, and sort of kind of using this trendy language, which excuses the sort of their penchant for living more hedonistically, living for partying and for sex, and a lot of these lifestyles which would have carried greater social consequences in former times.
Yeah, I mean, let me just read the first paragraph here on the blurb on Amazon. It says, in the current year, people live for today and fail to pay much attention for the future. We are distracted by 21st century versions of bread and circus. Several articles and entertainment narratives promote an empty, hollow existence, depicting family life as boring and oppressive, but encouraging present-minded and shallow thrills to fill the void, since many individuals have given up on certain received values greater than oneself. Family, religion, nation, the future becomes devoid of meaning, as there is presently little of significance, non-financial value worth preserving. Financially, as certain economic policies have creative incentive structures punishing long-term thinking while encouraging short-term consumption. So in a way, it's not just, of course, about maybe a critique of other civilizations that don't have time preference at all or lack of understanding of it. Your point is that this is something that now is starting to consume the West, a civilization, collectively speaking, that always had a very, very good understanding of time and the ability to plan, the ability to look forward. And of course, that's the very, you know, people can say that's due to the fact that the environment we kind of grew up with, if we were shaped by much cooler climates, maybe even pushing the boundaries of, as the ice age ended and the ice sheet started to retreat, we had to plan for the future. We had to have a vital understanding of time to be able to plan ahead. Otherwise, we literally wouldn't survive. But the point here, as I'm getting it, that's something that's starting to happen to us now. We're literally dropping this issue of saying what it's going to be 10, 20, 30 years down the line? What are we going to do? And that's leading to, among other things, of course, a demographic decline as well, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I do kind of briefly touch upon that. In Western countries, if you didn't plan ahead, if you ate the seed crop during the winter, you'd die out. So that would reinforce best behaviors if you wanted to ensure the survival of your in-group. Otherwise, well, I mean, they're not even relegated to a footnote in history. We don't know about them because they would have just died out. But places with more abundance in resources and more nutritious foods, well, they don't need to have such a diversified strategy going forward. So there is an allowance there to live for today and to continue surviving and doing so. And of course, you're probably well aware of the RK selection theory strategy when it comes to parental investment.
Yeah.
That these kind of patterns emerge, and there needs to be more of a territorial mindset, which comes with protecting one's resources and preserving the in-group over other groups, because that's a means by which you can forge trust going forward into the future, since you have a very sort of maybe a smaller area that you need to preserve. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about when it came to time preferences, that people with lower time preferences tend to be more intelligent than people who have higher time preferences. Of course, it's very difficult to quantify. They did actually have a study a few years ago where they offered people from different countries either $3,400 today or $3,800 in a month's time. And people who came from countries with higher IQs would go for the future option of $3,800 in a month's time over $3,400 today. But of course, it is pretty difficult to quantify. Now, in Western civilization, of course, not everyone has genius intelligence. So there needs to be incentive structures in place which reinforce people to have lower time preferences. And now the incentive structures we have economically, politically, socially, and irreligiously all promote present-mindedness, consumerism, consumption for the here and now, hedonism, all these behaviors which on a societal scale cannot last. And as a result, we've seen birth rates collapse. There's been this sort of deglorification of having children. It's not trendy to have kids. I've seen several articles slamming the formation of families in the media cycle. You see all these articles saying that having kids is unethical. It's bad for the environment. It's going to cost you a lot of money. You're not going to be able to party till 4 a.m. on a Wednesday night anymore. You can't travel the world. And it's basically all they're offering instead of having a family are just these instant gratification, these material sort of pursuits, which won't render you much happiness in the future. But they've been sort of elevated as the highest virtues by the media, by the entertainment industry, and by academia to kind of fill the void in your life until you basically croak, which is a very sad and sorry state of affairs. But this is the harsh reality of things now, that the kind of normie culture, the so-called normie culture that we have, is to promote instant gratification, is to promote just life being a succession of fleeting dopamine hits.
Now, do you think that's just a side effect of something else, of a behavior which we kind of adopted, maybe due to, how do I put it, maybe to a certain extent, the success of the material, ability, creature comforts, essentially, or is it a longer strategy behind that, do you think, promoted for very, very specific purposes?
Yeah, of course. It's being malignantly promoted by a lot of the institutions, such as I say, academia, entertainment, and the media. And of course, I make a few cases that a materialist society, a more secular society, is going to be one that's geared towards present consumption. Now, there are a lot of interest groups out there and mega corporations that need to make massive profits in the here and now. And if you had for example, a God-fearing society, which was family-oriented, they'd be less likely to consume these sort of vapid and useless gadgets than one which is more atomized and alienated with little to live for. So there is sort of a strategy from, I call it in the book just narrative complex, because it's a lot easier than just repeating entertainment, media, and academia every few paragraphs. But the fact of the matter is that they pump out an inauthentic narrative which promotes consumption, and it kind of discourages having an important, sort of placing emphasis in the importance of something immaterial or something that can't be commodified, such as family, nation, and faith. I think those are the three big points that I talk about the most. And I don't know if you've seen this tweet by the Spectator Index. They kind of have these nice polls out there, which they publish the results from time to time. And one of them which really struck me was a poll which showed what percentage of people would die for their countries. Of course, poorer countries and more religious countries would have higher rates of people who would be willing to risk their lives for their countries. And the more secular liberal ones had very, very low percentages. I think the lowest one was Japan, around 10%. Of course, if you look at sort of the other Western countries, they were between about 10 and 20%. It was very, very bleakly low. But the point is, and I'm going to be blunt, is who's going to die for neoliberalism? I don't think anybody out there, not even Francis Fukuyama, would die for neoliberalism. It's an ideology which doesn't really evoke much of an emotion. And this is the problem. People are very emotional creatures. I think it's a bit of a meme now, since, you know, we kind of, the left-right paradigm is within a liberal framework, and it kind of assumes that people are more rational than they actually are. People vote because, in many places in the UK, because their family voted for a certain political party, and there's more of an emotional attachment to them. So in a lot of working class areas, people would be voting for Labour, even though the Labour Party has abandoned them over the last 40, 50 years and gone more towards the middle class, educated, feminist type, or the coastal cosmopolitan city dwelling type, rather than the working class, in, as you can see by a few of their policies. So a lot of people tend to be more emotional than rational, and I think we've conned ourselves into believing that everyone's an irrational agent that can, you know, form all these complex decisions while holding down a job, while holding down a family, or attempting to, and while trying to navigate all these narratives that are being pumped out by the mainstream media, by academia, and by the entertainment industry, which is basically diametrically opposed to their future interests.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, there's one thing I want to ask you a little bit here about that, you know, the long term versus short term, and this issue that, you know, these big companies and so forth are long term shooting themselves in the foot due to the kind of ideology really that they're adopting right now. But before we go there, it's almost like a reverse thing has happened when it comes to, let's say, science then and rationality, right? That we maybe have generally this view in the West. Well, we've left these superstitious beliefs behind. We're less religious. We're more atheistic, which, you know, is kind of, there's a presumption in that means we're, you know, since we don't believe in God and are superstitious or gods or whatever, anything, any spiritual belief system, we are more prone to be rational. But ironically, it's actually reversed and a flip on that. As we get more and more emotional and left, maybe there was an in-between time, and maybe there was an ideal time or something where, you know, where, yes, we actually were more rational, let's say. But regardless, we've left that now, and people solely operate on impulses, on emotions, on what feels good in the moment, etc. So they've managed to switch this very successfully, where we think that, like, we're the greatest, we're the peak, I'm number one, so why try harder kind of thing. But the reality is this is collapsing, and it's collapsing fast, right?
Right, exactly. And I do kind of mention this in the book as well, that since all the intellectuals sing in unison the praises of sort of anti-nationalist globalism and neoliberal economics, then if you don't support these ideas, well, you must be some sort of dullard. You must be some sort of dunce, because all the intellectuals uniformly agree that this is a good thing. And, of course, people get their dopamine rocks off by saying, well, I support all these ideas. I'm against Trump. I'm against Brexit. I'm against all these populist movements, which are at odds to the neoliberal establishment. And, of course, you can basically sign away your future with a smile on your face and thinking you're an intellectual because all the other intellectuals hoisted up by the media say so. And what you're saying is pretty interesting about how we've become more impulsive than ever, even though it's suggested that we've become the most rational society in human history. It couldn't be further from the truth. I think
yeah.
Now that having an identity, having a former, maybe authentic identity, such as one belonging to a nation, and then, of course, the expressions of the nation would be faith of some description. Now that these former identities are so constantly maligned and excoriated by the media and by the entertainment industry, you have these narratives where it's the knuckle-dragging right-wing redneck who is the racist, he's bigoted, he's sexist, he's a little rapey, he's probably got violent tendencies and all these horrible things. So there is a clear narrative which depicts people who are against the kind of the progressive globalist establishment agenda as being these evil people. But going back to what I was saying about identity, now, a lot of people have had their history kind of hollowed out from underneath them. So I talk about there's a bit of an intergenerational gap between the subsequent generations after the Second World War, our parents, and today. So I think the millennial generation is very alienated, and it's not a happy generation. Things are pretty costly in a material context. And there isn't much of a spiritual refuge to go to, because all of these spiritual refuges, unless you live in maybe a bubble that promotes Christian values or that is nationalist, say if you live in the countryside, now that there isn't much opportunity in the countryside in a lot of Western countries, people have to flock to the cities, they need to find identities through another means. And a lot of the times, the shows you watch, the designer brands you wear, what you consume comes in as an identity in the place of where former identities used to lie. But this only is explicit to Westerners. I mean, you see a lot of people in California who are originally from Mexico. For example, that boxer that recently won that fight, he's a rotund fella, pretty strong looking. I forget his name, but he won a fight. And apparently he was born and raised in California, yet he's waving the Mexican flag. So he's allowed to have his received history. He's allowed to have his identity. And of course, the media isn't going to say, well, this is bad. Why do you have this bigoted nationalist identity behind you, even though you're raised in America? It surely, according to your framework, that doesn't make sense. But of course, he's allowed to. And if anything, it's encouraged. I remember hearing about this soccer game. It was a long time ago in Los Angeles, where basically anybody who was seeing had anything remotely to do with America was just drowned out by the Mexican crowd. So you're not allowed to have your own identity anymore. And what happens there? Well, people tend to be more consumerist when they need things to fill in that void, when they don't have a spiritual refuge to go to when things get tough.
So what do you make of that in terms of the short-term, the low-time preference then of I guess the whole system, really, just for simplification's sake? But we can, if it makes sense, we could break it down in industry or companies, you know, the corporate structure versus maybe government or even the NGOs that are, let's say, promoting both immigration. I know that you talk a lot about this, like this idea that we got to keep GDP up. Like that's the main issue. We got to keep populations high. And if these stupid, dumb idiots in the West don't have any babies, we have to import people to kind of not only make up for that, but actually continue the increase curve, right? So that might work for them in the short term. Now, we can even debate this issue over the economy due to the fact that many of these people that come in are largely unemployable, many are low educated, etc. So yes, maybe short term it helps to drive down the wages for these companies. And as long as the individuals that are coming in, let's say, if they don't make their own money, they receive them from the government or something like that, handouts, welfare, and then they can spend it on, you know, more useless kind of consumer products. But at some point, that circle we're in right now is going to break and fail. And either we're going to have a population collapse, or the money's not going to be enough, the financial issue is going to break us, etc. So it's not a, you know, it's not a smart strategy, obviously, long term, which I guess, you know, kind of makes your point to a certain extent. That means that all of us, even including the upper echelon, the elites, are suffering from the same kind of issue, really, when it comes to time preference, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's underscored by the fact that a lot of European leaders don't have any children of their own, so they don't have any tangible skin in the game after they're out of office. And of course, we have a one-man, one-vote, universal suffrage democratic system, which has now become sort of almost a demographic headcount in the West, which is why, on the one hand, the left likes importing a lot of people from third world countries, because they'll vote as a bloc. And the right, or the neoliberal right, likes a lot of mass immigration because their ability to consume in Western countries. I mean, I think a lot of them maybe realize that the jobs that a lot of people from third world countries aren't exactly going to be the doctors, lawyers, and engineers that we were promised. But even if they were to live on welfare, the ability of somebody to consume, say, from Guatemala or sub-Saharan Africa, their ability to consume in a megacorporation is going to be far greater if they're living off welfare in a first world country than it would be if they were just trying to make ends meet back at home. So I think that's another reason for it as well, because they can consume a lot more being in Western countries than they would be, say, back at home in Mali or Guatemala or wherever it is. And it's a real sorry state of affairs, you know, because politicians now think in election cycles. I saw a pretty interesting graph when I was living in Argentina of economic policies the year of election. So two things would happen. One, on the year of an election, you'd see public spending go up. So there's an illusion of economic activity. So there's an illusion that public works are being done by that politician, just so it's within the living memory of the electorate, because their living memory isn't very long on the whole, unfortunately. And the other thing is lowering of interest rates to boost short-term investment. So there's another illusion of economic productivity. So it looks like the economy is doing well when it's time for re-election. Of course, sometimes lowering interest rates in a modern economy means that there's a misallocation of credit to companies who may not be able to survive in the long term. But that doesn't really matter, because you think in terms of election cycles. And one of the big problems, and I do dedicate a chapter to the boomer. I know the boomer are sort of the...
I'm just looking at that, actually, highlighting it in chapter 10, the boomers. Tell us about it.
Well, I talk about, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the people who were raised with the civil rights. So we're just, like, the decade of the 60s was probably the most spiritually and demographically destructive decade in Western history. And one of the problems is now is they instead of, you know, practicing savings or long-term investments in order to protect their future income for when they're retired, for their pensions, of course, they brought in all these generous social welfare programs. And I know that you're not going to ever be able to undo social welfare programs in the current state, but they brought in a lot of these programs irresponsibly, which they're never going to pay for. And then at the same time, they lived a life of hedonism on the whole, not all of them, of course, which precluded the possibility of having larger families, because larger families need responsibility. You need to be able to be committed to having that large family, and having a large family gets in the way of sort of the self-empowerment, which came with the feminist ideologies, which really opened a sort of Pandora's box of social liberalization in the 60s and 70s. So while people were going off being empowered and stuff, well, they didn't have a mother in the household and they have to be raised by a daycarer, or they can't afford to have as many kids. So a lot of it was very present-minded without much thought in the future. And now we're seeing a situation where, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to pay for these state pensions going forward, because it's a bit of a Ponzi scheme. A lot of the times, instead of having kids who would help you out for your golden years, you're now relying on a bureaucrat that doesn't really care about you. And it's not only just a bureaucrat, it's a change of administration several times over during your working career, to the point where, you know, now it's not really as solvent as it was back when you started all these general social programs. So now your chickens are coming home to roost. And of course, there are consequences to your actions. And this is one of the big problems with modern society, is the illusion that there won't be consequences for sort of these undesirable behaviors in the here and now. So, for example, you could live as a hedonist today. You can party till 4 a.m. several times a week. But of course, somebody's going to have to pick up the tab. And now there's a lot of I don't really want to say social construct, but it's become more socially acceptable to live more promiscuously, live more for the here and now. You're not allowed to judge people. Nobody's allowed to be elevated to a position of authority to say, well, actually, no, partying 4 times a week till 4 a.m. is not good for you. It's not good for your finances. It's not good for your health. But now it's kind of looked down on to say something like that, because it would infer that somebody's speaking from a position of power or authority, which is a big no-no, especially in more progressive circles.
Yeah.
So there's like an illusion that there won't be as many consequences. So, for example, one of the big things I talk about are alternative family structures such as single motherhood, which wouldn't be possible in an environment where A, there's, well, a God-fearing society, and B, the introduction of a welfare state, because in the book The Bell Curve, they had a graph of single motherhood rates, which would hover around 5% pretty steadily up until about the mid-60s, of course. Before the introduction of these big welfare programs, there was a huge social change as well, which led to people wanting to have this social safety net just in case they were to get into trouble. But of course, that has been exploited and used to shield people from the consequences of their actions. So instead of people waiting till marriage to have kids, of course, this, I'm not being naive in saying that people would have waited till marriage every single time, but the fact of the matter is the rates of children born out of wedlock was significantly lower then than it is today, because there were these social incentive structures in place which would punish people to having children out of wedlock, and of course you'd get into trouble. And this is one of the things that have been lost in the last two generations. And now, if you're in the UK or something like that, and you say that, well, maybe single motherhood isn't a good thing, maybe people living on welfare and being dependent isn't a good thing, you're going to just get hounded out. Of course, there are people who need help, and there are people who have been alienated by globalism and neoliberal economic policies. I'm not denying that at all, but the fact of the matter is you have an incentive structure in place which actually discourages people to be future-oriented, which is a huge, huge problem. And it also indicates a wider social problem that we have, in that we are kind of deprived of meaning, since all these things that the West was founded upon, all these wonderful values that we've inherited, are now no longer allowed to be appreciated, such as the nation and the idea of the family and faith to a certain degree. And
core issue there, to be honest? Why would any of these, be they millennials or zoomers or even boomers for that matter, or Generation X, work to preserve something if they largely just don't know what it is or how they're, what kind of luxurious situation they're in, really? And it's almost like this inescapable kind of cycle, right? That you, the more success you have, material wealth, creature comfort to a certain extent, you do create lazy individuals. They haven't fought for what they have. They've been handed way too much. And of course, as we know, then that's when that cycle kind of begins over again, when people are forced and the situations become more difficult. People really have to struggle and fight for what they have. And then they become appreciate much more what it is that they have. Because they have some part in creating it themselves, right? So there is a I don't know how to break that cycle, but there always is that disconnection that if you were handed something by your ancestors, really, and you didn't know what that entailed or what struggles they had to make sure that we had these things, we're not going to appreciate those things, right?
That's exactly right. And it's almost forbidden to be appreciative of the history that you have received and the civilization that you inherited. So you have this disconnection of your past, and it's kind of your whole being is evil. It's fraudulent. It was built on colonialism. It was built on slavery. It was built on all these horrible internecine wars. And you don't deserve to be living with this privilege and luxury, and you need to be reminded of it constantly by the mainstream media and the entertainment industry, which is why a lot of people don't really have meaning in their lives, and which is why a lot of people don't have children of their own, is because I don't think that they really have much to live for per se, given the fact that you are being hounded by the people who guide the narrative to despise yourself. You're kind of living in a way of self-loathing. So how do you pass the time when you have free time? Well, you consume that, because that's the only thing that's socially acceptable. And it's really, 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 really tragic state of affairs. And one of the other things which you mentioned about how we've got all this material wealth, I actually devote a chapter on technology, is that there is no need to wait for tomorrow anymore, since you can get anything at the press of a button.
Yeah.
In the 2008 crisis in the UK, roughly about 20-25% of high street shops closed down. So now you don't even need to go to your high street shop in order to pick up something. You could just go on Amazon, or you could just go somewhere else to order whatever you need. You don't need to leave the comfort of your home.
Two-day shipping tyranny.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is that there is no need for discipline anymore. Almost all physical and mental hardship has been removed. So on the mental side, you know, if you're kind of weak will, well, it's okay. We'll accept you for who you are. You don't need to improve yourself. There's a sort of a very maternalistic side to society, especially in cities now, where if you're a little overweight, well, you look good the way you are. You can have an extra slice of pizza. I mean, you're fine just the way you are. And there's this sort of the striving towards mediocrity on the mental side. And on the physical side, well, what would happen if, say, people just ran out of power for a couple of days? How would they survive? They wouldn't know what to do. Which is why you see all these survival shows where you have these people living in cities on their lives. And within a couple of hours, they just implode because they don't know how to deal with anything. They never had to suffer hardship on their own.
Sorry to interrupt, but I have to mention that we're so close to literally like being in a scenario where like people start eating each other. Yeah, there's been calculations of people like we're like two weeks away from like a total just bloody, maybe not an organized revolution, but the people would be turning on each other over resources. If the trucks stop going to the store with the deliveries, I mean, that's it. If there's an EMP or any other kind of thing that is causing the electricity to shut down or water or something like that, we don't know. It would be mass carnage on a scale that we've never seen before.
Yeah, that's right. And I was talking to a friend about this the other day, that a lot of our supply chain relies on just-in-time. So if one of those gets knocked out, it just screws up the whole supply chain. And what will you do? What will you do? People don't know how to fend for themselves. A lot of people who live in big cities don't have time to hit the gym. And I do mention going to the gym as being an important part of trying to instill the best behaviors and best practices for yourself. And one of the things which is lost in the West is discipline. And I do make a distinction between low impulse control and I call it the will to gratification. It's like the will to consume. Like more intelligent people won't just act on impulses. They'll do things where they won't have their ability to consume impinge in the future. So say, for example, somebody who may be very consumeristic, they won't sort of commit a crime in order to get what they need because they realize that there will be future consequences for their freedom and their ability to consume in the future. But this is a huge problem. Like nobody knows what it is to have discipline, which is why a lot of things aren't appreciated anymore. We just go from one bit of consumption to the next, one dopamine hit to the next. And another thing I briefly touch upon is the kind of the politics of dopamine hits. So you have a lot of virtue signaling now, and people do it because it makes them feel good about themselves, and it gives them a bit of purpose, and they feel good about themselves, and they get social affirmation for saying that Trump is racist or whatever it could be on social media, or being out and about in an anti-Trump protest like we've seen in London today. So a lot of their life is just arranged around how can I get a temporary hit of pleasure, and a lot of people arrange their life around just fleeting bits of pleasure. There is nothing greater than themselves involved. It's a very selfish mindset, and it's a very pleasure-based mindset. They're kind of chasing the dragon, per se, when it comes to getting new experiences and new dopamine hits. And it's a real sorry state of affairs. And I see some of these people, and they just look so sad.
And, oh, yeah. Empty, hollowed out. They're used up, and you know, essentially they've been through it all at the age of 23 or something these days, you know. There's no innocence left, and as you said regarding technology too, that it gives us this kind of false sense of progress too, because there's always something new. There's, you know, newer apps or newer things within the technology sphere to lose yourself on, and I would extend that to, you know, gaming and stuff like that too, or virtual reality, or all these traps of things that we can fall into and end up spending all our time on, and because it does to a certain extent fill that temporary void. If we only had that one thing, we'd eventually become tired of it and we'd move on, or we'd feel we weren't satisfied by this. But since there's a constant stream of just new things to get into or look at or play or whatever it is, that reality never really hits people, right?
Exactly. And another thing that I talk about along those lines is this sort of inauthenticity that people are living. So if you sort of take a step back and think about the luxury and the technology that we have, when in human history has anyone lived like this? When in human history have people voluntarily wanted just not to have any children and just give basically live nihilistically on almost a collective level? Of course, I don't have many accounts of the last days of Rome, but that's maybe what I imagine what it'd be like, sort of people sort of finding emotional surrogates for the children they didn't have in wanting people from, say, Mexico or Syria to come and live with them. And I see that quite a lot. For example, the Swedish girl last year who got arrested for preventing the deportation of a wife-beating man. I can't remember where he was from. I think it was Afghanistan or Somalia. And there's another one where people, just random people, got together to prevent the deportation of a convicted Somalian rapist in the UK. So there is almost collective lack of self-confidence, largely due to the narratives that are pumped out by the mainstream media, by academia, by the entertainment industry. And they're living a life which it doesn't align with reality itself, unfortunately. So the kind of, I don't want to sound corny, but they're kind of living a simulation. They're kind of living a life that's been represented not to be the way it actually is. And you can see the consequences of that. You can see that people are taking opioids in America. People are taking SSRIs. People, especially, and I've noticed this through the way people vote, that people on the left, almost all the way across the board, people who vote for the Democratic Party, have high rates of mental illnesses, except for autism, which was higher among Republicans than it was for Democrats and independents. So what does that tell you? There must be some form of cognitive dissonance. Unfortunately, for a lot of the intellectual Democrats you see in places like New England, they live in a little social bubble where they don't have to confront reality for what it is, and they can continue to live their lives in their homogenous gated communities, which a lot of other people simply aren't afforded. And I think that this inauthenticity really affects them and really batters their self-confidence and kind of gets imprinted into their psyche to the point where they don't want to reproduce. And in my opinion, just sort of voluntarily not wanting to reproduce comes across to me as a prolonged form of suicide. Because what are you doing? You're just rooting yourself out of the gene pool in favor of what? Some sort of trendy language which says, well, we shouldn't have kids because it's bad for the environment. Well, who's going to inherit that environment after you've gone if you're not going to have kids?
Yeah, especially those who ironically then think about that. Those who have the capability of educating their kids on those issues, or whether it is something that's even tied to the genetics, is kind of irrelevant. It's like, well, you have then obviously a responsibility to make things better, and the best way to do that is to have more people that care about the issues that you care about. But I don't know, I just see this as a kind of a, you know, despite mankind's success, again, primarily materialistically, we have not escaped the clutches of nature. We think we have to a certain extent. And of course, as we see with all this, you know, trans madness and things like this, we're fighting this every day. It's, you know, research to do, you know, artificial uteruses for men so they can have babies. You know, it's like nature needs to be broken down and destroyed for their system to kind of, you know, fully bloom to a certain extent. But I believe we haven't escaped the clutches of that. So in a roundabout way, you know, Orwell, I think that it's like it's nature that somehow is operating through us. And those people who are, let's face it, least, you know, prone to have kids, isn't that nature just kind of operating and making sure then that those who lack those impulses literally are taking themselves out? No one is doing this to them. It's not like a you know, some big eugenics experiment, but in a roundabout way, nature is ensuring that there still is eugenics there. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right. And Ed Dutton's got an interesting take about this. I don't recall writing it in the book, but he mentioned that people with a lot of these mindsets are mutants, sort of post-industrial revolution mutants, people who wouldn't have otherwise survived under harsher, more Darwinian conditions, who do survive, but instead of having children of their own, they manage to affect change through their ideas and through what they do to our current institutions. Now, there are very, 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 very few institutions in Western countries that aren't overtly left-leaning, if any at all. So they have had their imprint, and you can see with the birth rates between the left and the right that people on the left, on the fringes of each group are, well, on the left, they're having very few kids. It's about, I think it was like 0.8 on the fringe on the left, and then on the right, it goes up to about 2.5-ish kind of area. So, I mean, it's not a self-propagating ideology, what these people are living through, because it doesn't coincide with a lot of people's experiences. And I'd go into how a lot of the narratives people are spoon-fed from about age 3. So a lot of modern parents have to put their kids into daycare, so they aren't raised by their own parents. They suffer this sort of emotional deprivation since they don't have this proximity to their parents in the most important years. And then they go into public schooling until they're 18, maybe go for another 3, 4, 5 years in higher education, and they're faced with nothing but these sort of self-hating narratives, which, you know, are sort of dressed as the pinnacle of intellectual achievement by an overwhelmingly left-wing academia. And the peer review process is very skewed to one way as well. It isn't exactly genuine, since there has to be some form of ideological conformity within those ranks. And then when they go out into the real world, a lot of the experiences don't match up to what they see on Netflix or what they read in whatever books they've been put on their reading list. So
yeah.
A lot of the time, it doesn't quite add up. They've been told that there is this lovely world out there, where everyone is sort of equal, interchangeable. It's all nice. If it weren't for the evil white man oppressing everyone else, we'd all live in this utopia where there'd just be happiness, unicorn and rainbow. It'd be, what was it called? Fully automated gay space luxury communism or something like that. but unfortunately, it couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
And when they go out into the real world, they're just met with that reality, which they can't seem to stomach. And they either abandon those beliefs as soon as they start a family, or they become very sort of sorry figures. And it's really, really sad. And I actually genuinely feel sorry for them, because they've lived a narrative and not a reality.
Yeah, exactly. They're living, you know, again, but this is the point of them being driven by impulses. And again, someone else's, maybe not desires, but their desires are there because someone else has told them what they should, you know, think or what they should aspire to, essentially. It's the same thing with, like, you know, these women, they're watching, like, these, you know, elaborate, you know, wedding ceremonies or whatever, or they're looking at these, you know, these romantic comedies or something, and they have this idea of what relationship and marriage and all these things are supposed to be like. And when that doesn't match up, they kind of just, well, something is wrong. I'm not finding the right person to be with or something. And that could literally lead them down into a trap where they never get a husband, they never get a family, they never have kids, because they're aspiring to an ideal and something which they've been programmed with, which, sure, for some it might exist, but it's certainly not the norm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's mirrored in the fact that you see dozens of articles from women probably in the early to mid to even late 30s and sometimes in their 40s complaining about, well, where are the real men? Why aren't there any nice guys my age? Well, unfortunately, your sexual market value plummets a lot sooner than a man's. And, well, a lot of men your age or slightly older than you aren't going to be interested in you anymore. And this is a sad reality that people have had the truth embargoed from them for such a long time. And it runs along the line, runs down the lines of sort of this equality, in a way that men and women are interchangeable. They can compete with one another. They both have the anatomy to do so. They both can, they're both as strong as each other. Of course, less and less people are believing that now with the emergence of all these trans athletes who just seem to clean up shop when it comes to competing in women's sports. For example, the last one was this guy who competed as a man, and he ranked in sort of the middle hundreds somewhere in high schools, and he competed as a woman and just completely blew everyone out of the water. So I think that there's definitely a lot of validity to what you're saying. And I think that when it comes to women, it affects them a lot harder than it does to men. So you see a lot of people kind of projecting and LARPing as dressing as a character from the Handmaid's Tale. Because I think it's a projection of what, in a way, of what they left behind. They left behind the possibility to start a family and have children because they were sold a narrative where they believed in the highest pinnacle of their own self-empowerment, which they were never able to realize. And even if they were to get to the top of their field, I hear all the time of these cases of these very decorated scientists and businesswomen who regret not starting a family because they focused on their career. And it's very, very sad because that's irreparable.
Exactly. Actresses, showing an article here now, 31 of them, you know, and many, some of them really like have gone hard on this issue of regretting it. You know, some people, I forget her name now, she stopped acting and she spoke out and she was very depressed about this issue. And, you know, they had, in some cases, they have millions. There's no excuse. Even if they didn't have the time, they could literally like hire the help that was necessary and everything. There was no excuses whatsoever. And they never went on to do it because it was this self-serving, selfish, just, you know, whirlwind they probably were in with all the, you know, success and attention and all this kind of stuff. And then, as you say, they wake up on the backside of that with a pretty severe hangover, and realize once, you know, their fame is beginning to plummet and they don't get as many roles anymore, then what are they going to do? Right?
It's
horrific.
Exactly. And I think what really underpins that is the fact that the consequences of these actions aren't revealed to them. They
exactly.
don't know what's going to happen if they do these things and if it doesn't work for them. Even if they do succeed, they often end up regretting it because the consequences aren't told to them. They're just told, this is empowering, this is great for you, you go girl, you be a superwoman, you can do all these things, you can smash the patriarchy, you don't have to have kids, this is going to derive more happiness than having kids. And when the day actually comes that they realize that they can't have kids anymore, well, I'm sorry, but that ship has sailed and you were sold a narrative. You weren't sold a reality. And after that, they really start to suffer.
The fact that there's no, like, I mean, I know that there's no responsibility by media or anything like that, right? But it's like the fact that there's, like, no one, as far as I know anyway, that has a news show, a movie, a documentary or something that, and again, maybe they're out there, I'm just not aware of it, but that's there and like kind of just gives the other side, right? And just, well, you know, just keep in mind, like, okay, you might believe all these things now, but, you know, you might change your mind or just offering that different. All of that, as you said, that's vehemently broken down and put down and casing point. This is actually something I want to dive a little bit deeper into part two. We're going to take a break here just shortly. I want to make sure we plug your book and stuff like that, but let me just show the screenshot. Actually, their website, I don't know if you saw this, was a Amazon documentary in three parts about the Gloria Vale Christian community in New Zealand. They actually have the highest birth rates of any group in the world right now. Very interesting. Okay. And they're, of course, highly attacked. It's like, you know, if you look at like the articles that's written about it, it's like how women are suppressed, they only wear, there's a Christian weird cult and stuff like that. But the reality is that it's like, yes, they, to a certain extent, there are some simplified things in their life. Maybe they don't have all the complications, if I can put it that way, that we have. But the reality is, when you look at these three parts, they're all very happy. There's no one in the community which is like, maybe I'm a trans woman, right? You know, there's no, like, none of these kind of side effects, if you will, of freedom that we get, right? It's so open, it's so you can be anything, or anything might be. No, we don't know anything. You know, this kind of attitude, and it really is, at the end of the day, is a disservice. That when you do have strict, I don't know if this is the right wording, but kind of behavioral guidelines or something, et cetera, like a somewhat restricted experience, it's, I think, as a human being, it's more prone that you'll be happy within that. Now, having said that, there are going to be individuals that want to, and that's fine that they want to go outside of that. You have the philosophers, you have some of the, you know, wackier people, and there's upsides to that of having those individuals who venture outside of the of the normal kind of confines, if you will, of what life should be. But that's definitely not for everybody. And that's kind of the lifestyle that has been promoted now, that freedom above everything, right? You can do whatever you want, individuality. But look at the state, as you said, with antidepressants and stuff. Look at the how sad and depressed most people are, right?
Exactly. And what's really, really cruel, actually, and as you said, it was a disservice, and that's correct, is to tell people, because, you know, beforehand, they are kind of hollowed out in terms of their identity. So they're kind of made into a little bit of a blank slate. And you have maybe the teachers, who might be possibly a cat lady or something, who tells, like, the kid that, you know, who eats the glue, that if he wants to be an astronaut, he can do if he puts his mind to it. Unfortunately, people do have limitations. And this idea that everyone has the possibility of equal and unlimited possibilities or potentialities is simply cruel. People need to be aware of their limits. Of course, I don't mean strive towards a mediocrity, but realize that you can't do it all. And unfortunately, this is hard truth for a lot of modern women who think that they can have it all. They think that they can become the supermom who has a career job, who out earns her husband, who can come back, have a satisfying sex life, and then have girl nights out and, you know, be a full-time mom as well. It's just impossible. There are only 24 hours in a day, and a third of that time needs to be occupied by resting. So you need to come to these realizations. And I myself needed to recognize these limitations as well as I was writing this book. I thought maybe I could do X amount of hours a day, when in fact it's impossible. Life has other demands other than sort of the pursuit of material gain, which is one of the biggest problems that we're facing today, that there isn't much of immaterial substance out there apart from chasing dollars and spending and consuming and living for the moment. Of course, anything else, anything that derives greater meaning or satisfaction is considered bad, evil, oppressive. And the last thing was this idea of almost infinite freedom. But in reality, it's freedom from oneself. It's freedom from one's own limitations. It's freedom from one's traditions. It's freedom from one's received history. It's freedom from one's identity. It's freedom from all these sort of social parameters, which would be there not to restrict you, but to keep you moored, to keep you anchored in a very rapidly changing world. And just the last thing I wanted to quickly say was, it's very difficult to have low time preferences or to be future oriented when things such as language just changes on such a quick basis, when truth itself just shifts from time to time, and it's shifting at such a fast pace because of technology, because of the availability of information at our fingertips, through handheld devices, through tablets, through social media, and through all these other things, which are wonderful, and they've done a great number on dismantling the globalist agendas, but at the same time, they do cause these big problems on a societal level where people can't really live for the future. I mean, just think of it this way. If there's one of the reasons why long-term investments are perceived to be riskier is because there's more possibilities that can occur between the immediate time where you take on that investment and the payoff date. So more things can go wrong in that time, which is why they tend to carry a higher risk factor to them. But now, say, things change at such a quick pace. Like words themselves, for example, the word queer, 30 years ago it's fine, 10 years ago it's not fine, now it's empowering. Who knows what to think? And it's the same with people of color and colored people. Colored people was fine 10 years ago, now it's not. Now people of color is fine, but they're basically the same thing. And just things like that. Because the prevailing socially acceptable politics dictates that, you know, this is what is moral, and unfortunately a lot of people do follow the moral framework of the globalist the globalist superstructures that we see. Even people on the right, they want to desperately prove how they're not racist, not sexist to their progressive peers, who don't really care about it, and just use these moral frameworks just to destroy them as a viable political movement.
Yeah, I think the trick there is they want to keep us guessing. That's very there's a huge advantage in that. If we don't really know which word to use, what we can say, or, you know, it keeps us very much restricted. Of course, self-censoring and limited in terms of expressing our opinions, what we actually feel and think about stuff. So that's very intentional, I feel. But we're going to take a break here in a little bit, but let's plug your stuff. And so Amazon, is that the best place to go to get a copy? You have Kindle paperback version available as well. Tell us all about it.
Yes, I have a Kindle and a paperback version. I only released it on the first of this month. So if you're interested in picking up a copy, please do and help me out. And I also have a YouTube channel, which you can go to, which is just Orwell Good. And I stream a couple of times a week on that, if you want to check that out too.
Yeah, absolutely. Check it out, guys, and make sure that you do pick up a copy. Support Orwell and Good's work, of course, very important. You can also find more at newmediacentral.net, which you guys should check out as well. A lot of good news, a lot of good stories. You and the co-hosts over, which are the other co-hosts that stream on the YouTube channel, by the way?
We have Ian Erickson. I forgot his Twitter handle, but he's a good guy, and we stream almost every fortnight because, you know, things out of our control limit the possibility for us to stream more often.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have links to the YouTube channel, to New Media Central, and, of course, to Orwell and Good's Twitter account, and, obviously, to the book as well. Definitely check it out, guys, if you want to find out more. There's a lot of good chapters in here, a lot of good things we haven't even gotten to and able to discuss yet. We'll dive into more of that in part two as we continue here. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back as we continue to talk about A Matter of Time, how time preferences make or break civilization. We'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue in part two with Orwell and Good. Make sure that you tune in as we continue talking more about the situation in terms of the media, the establishment, birth rates. We're going to talk about South Africa towards the end. A lot of great topics coming up, so definitely make sure you don't miss it. Head on over to redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership. You can try it out from 3 months. We have subscriptions going all the way up to 2 years as well. And, of course, you get a discount for the longer subscription that you get as well. But yeah, check it out. A lot of good stuff in there. Weekend Warrior shows exclusive, second hour of most of our interview shows as well, and also other exclusive videos for you guys. So check it out. Thank you so much for watching. We'll be right back after a short break. Stay tuned.